Hi, and welcome to SpondyCast, where we bring together the best medical minds, thought leaders, scientists, patients, and caregivers to inform and inspire the spondylitis community. I'm your host, Jill Miller, living my best spa life, knowing that how we meet today has the power to change everything going forward. Please note that the information provided in this podcast should not be considered medical advice. We do encourage all listeners to consult their healthcare professionals for medical concerns. Thank you for listening, and we hope you find our discussion today enlightening. Hi, and welcome to SpondyCast. Today, our guest is author of Speak Up Culture, Stephen Shedletsky, or Shed, as his friends like to call him. He helps leaders make it safe and worth it for people to speak up. He supports humble leaders, those who know they are part of the problem they experience and the solutions that they can create as they put their people and purpose first. Shed is a sought-after speaker, coach, and advisor, and has led hundreds of keynote presentations, workshops, and leadership development programs around the world. As a thought leader on psychological safety in the workplace, he supports leaders and organizations in all industries where human beings work. He is, again, the author of the newly released Speak Up Culture, When Leaders Truly Listen, People Step Up. After years on a corporate track, Shed was introduced to and inspired by the work of Simon Sinek, and soon after meeting him, became the fourth person to join his team. For more than a decade, Shed has contributed at Simon Sinek, Inc., where he was chief of staff, head of brand experience, training and development. He headed a global team of speakers and facilitators, and he continues to speak and facilitate with Simon Sinek, helping to create a more inspired, safe, and fulfilled world. Shed graduated from the Richard Ivey School of Business with a focus on leadership, communication, and strategy. And he also received his coaching certification from the Coactive Training Institute. He lives in Toronto with his wife and two young children. Shed, it's so nice to see you again. How are you? And thank you.
Thank you. It's fun to see you in this format. The last time we were together was over a lovely dinner. So good, yes. Good to be back in the virtual space here.
Yes. And I was particularly interested in having you on in this idea of, in SpondyCast, on the idea of so many of the listeners face daily, probably in their jobs, something where speak up culture and a culture of belonging doesn't exist. So I think it's so important because particularly like spondyloarthritis is often an invisible disease. And finding your voice in that alongside the leaders in your business or in your daily life, right? It can be your family or a different context, I think. Finding your voice in order to lead is really important. So can you start by giving us an overview of Speak Up and how its principles can be particularly meaningful for people with a chronic illness or living with spondyloarthritis?
Yeah, thank you, Jill. And such an important conversation that I'm delighted to hop in with you today. I think it's so key both in how can we find our voice, help others find their voice, and how can allies step up? Like I'm not someone who at present suffers from a chronic disease or illness, but how can I increase my awareness so that I can be a better ally for that population as well? I actually just this morning came from a breakfast with someone who's neurodiverse. And that's another form of sort of DEIB, diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging, where it's hidden. Yeah. You know, oftentimes folks who are neurodiverse, whether that's autism spectrum or whatever it might be, it's another one of these diversity pieces that we can't necessarily see. And why I'm so intrigued in both neurodiversity and chronic illness is if we can solve or make momentum or progress with belonging with these populations, we end up making a ton of progress with all populations, which is really right. Interesting for me. So yeah, I mean, I wrote this book. It came out last fall in October 2023. When I first started writing it, Jill, I thought I was simply rebranding psychological safety. Psychological safety has become a hot topic, very much put on the map by a great professor out of Harvard and scholar, Amy Edmondson. But even Amy herself says, not a fan of the term. She actually inherited the term because when she was early in her career, she wrote a paper and one of the reviewers said, oh, you're talking about psychological safety, to which she said, okay, if it gets me published, I'll just use that.
Right.
But it's not the best term. It doesn't really describe what's inside the label on that jar, if you will. And so as I first started writing this book, I leaned into good old Zig Ziglar, people don't buy drills, they buy holes. And so if the drill is psychological safety, the hole, the result is of what you get is a speak up culture. However, as I delved in and dove into the phenomena of what does it mean to feel that it's worth it, safe and worth it to speak up, it's both of those things. So A, it's psychologically safe to speak up. I feel as though the strength of our relationship, whether it's friends, workplace, boss, colleagues, that there's a psychological safety. It feels safe to take interpersonal risk. But the other and just as important piece is, does it feel worth it? That how many times do we go back to a dry well, even if it's safe, praying that water is just going to appear? If we keep going back and water doesn't appear, it's not worth it. The perception of impact isn't there.
Double click on that for me, like an example.
Well, so I was told by Kim Scott, who wrote the book Radical Candor, that if you write a business book, there needs to be a 2x2 framework. So I went for a long drive and finally came up with one.
Okay.
It's these two pieces. It's this dual axis of, on one axis, it's safety. The opposite of safety is fear. On the other axis, it's impact. On the other end of impact is apathy. So in a speak up culture, it both feels safe and worth it to speak up. Now, speaking up isn't without fear. There's still risk. The goal isn't fearlessness. That's actually inhumane. That's why I harp against the term fearless leader. It's like, fearless leader? Really? Like, no. Fear is important. If you truly come across a fearless leader, they're dangerous. They're destructive. Fear is a risk modulator. It's data to help us make the choice of, do you pursue? Do you pause? Do you get out of there? Right? When you have safety but no impact, this is either due to systemic bureaucracy issues or a change in habit that's simply too hard. No matter how safe you feel, nothing's going to change. You don't want the lower left quadrant, which is it doesn't feel safe, it doesn't feel worth it. That's an unhappy marriage between fear and apathy. And I've been there in my career as well. No fun. But a really interesting one is, it isn't safe, but it's worth it. This is where you often get whistleblowing. And folks like Ed Pearson, who was at Boeing, as well as Dr. Kimberly McClear, who was at the U.S. Coast Guard, openly gay, Black, PhD captain, very senior. She was the target of harassment, and she spoke up out of survival. And then folks flocked to her who had a similar experience. So that's sort of the full landscape of, ideally, it both feels safe and it both feels worth it. And that's when you can have a thriving speak up culture, where folks can talk about their struggles, talk about their concerns, talk about their ideas and feedback as well.
Right. And I'm thinking through, like, you know, some people's journeys in terms of having a chronic illness at work. There is often this fear of repercussion for talking about it.
Yeah.
And maybe we can, well, let's just go down the rabbit hole now. how can we use our own voices to, like, work our way towards safety?
Yeah. That's an interesting question. How can we use our voices to work our way towards safety? The interesting thing about a speak up culture and feeling that it's safe and worth it to use our voice is, it's a dance, it's a tango. And any tango takes at least two parties. So one is there work that we need to do? Is there a perception we have that might be getting in the way, like previous bosses or previous colleagues? So, you know, anytime we walk into a relationship, we are wearing a backpack. Some people call it baggage, you know, sort of an emotional backpack or a psychological safety backpack, that the way things have gone in the past dictate or can influence how we behave in the present, regardless of whether that's a psychologically safe relationship or not. So I think there's often work we can do in taking modest, reasonable tests just to see. So one piece is, what's the evidence to say whether it's psychologically safe or not? And how much interpersonal risk have we tried to take? Now, I'm not saying you should take the hugest risk on day one unless you really want to find out someone's true colors. But right. How can you test the waters just a little bit? But it's always a dance, and it's always a tango. And the more influence one has in a culture, sometimes by seniority or authority, sometimes by your behavior, right? Leadership is a behavior. The more influence one has, the more their individual values and behavior impact the dynamic of that culture, that relationship. So, you know, safety in a relationship is not on any one person, it's on all people. So if you or I are colleagues and we're working together, what's the condition that I'm creating to make it safe and worth it for you to tell me about your real honest experience, such that I can show up and design our relationship and our experiences for the both of us to thrive?
Okay, so let's talk about that a bit. What inspired you to write Speak Up? And I know you don't have a ton of personal connections to spondyloarthritis, but I imagine you had some of your own experiences and personal connections around all of these different diverse facets of human beings. Yeah. But what was the impetus for Speak Up?
So two, I mean, I do have a chronic condition, which is a stutter. So I still have a speech impediment. I married a speech therapist. Good choice.
Yes.
more so for my kids and nieces and nephews. But it still comes in handy. But yeah, I mean, I grew up knowing what it felt like to be voiceless. I first really became aware that I had a stutter in grade two. We sort of successfully didn't do too much about it because the initial therapies that we got weren't particularly effective. They more so focused on counting the bad behavior, which was odd. Oh. They wanted me to count my stutters. I guess counting them would help me build awareness and slow down. But it's like, you know, to a kid in grade two, let's do an inverse correlation to help you. Like, no. Like,
it didn't make sense. That doesn't work.
And it wasn't the most popular thing, acting like I was a bouncer at a club counting my stutters out in the recess playground. So that lasted successfully for about an hour and a quarter. And okay. that clicker went back in my knapsack and then went into my desk drawer at home. Growing up and knowing intimately the feeling of voicelessness, sort of between from grade two, I finally got help in grade six, but didn't really overcome a fear of public speaking, whether it was in front of a large group or smaller groups, until I was in college, early on in college, mostly because I put myself in positions where I had to speak, whether it was performances at summer camp or stepping into leadership roles where there was an expectation to speak publicly. So that was definitely one huge piece of inspiration. And sort of the good old Danish theologian Kierkegaard, one of my favorite quotes is, life makes sense looking backwards, but it must be lived forwards. So as I look back, so much of my passion and strengths are really born from the fact that I overcome challenges with speaking and speaking up, and having my voice and my ideas and emotions clearly articulated. It's become a strength. And I'm a big believer that what we can overcome, especially in young in life, can become strengths as adults. The other piece, Jill, is I've been working in career for nearly 20 years now, and I've seen a myriad of cultures and a myriad of leaders and their behaviors. And I've been parts of organizations where there is a speak up culture, and I've been parts of organizations where there isn't. I mean, my first day in my corporate career ever, 1,000 people were let go post-merger. And so I saw, it was like a front row seat to organizational behavior. I saw the impact of decisions and leadership behaviors and transparency, and quite frankly, lack thereof, its impact, not just on folks' productivity, but their health and well-being. Yeah. And I've been parts of teams that, whether clients of mine or being on those teams, where there was a speak up culture, but then change in leaders made that speak up culture, just obliterated it. And so I've seen sort of a full spectrum of what's possible for the results of a team in an organization, as well as the quality of relationships. I have best friends that I'm not on the team with them anymore, but we had this amazing experience on this team that we still to this day are best friends, as well as the impact of having a speak up culture on our health and well-being. You know, we know from UKG and the National Institute of Health that our relationship with our direct boss has more of an impact on our health than that of our relationship with our family doctor. And the impact of the relationship with our boss is at par on the impact of our health and well-being is that of our relationship with our life partner, if we have one. And so the relationship we have with our direct boss hugely impacts our health and well-being. So I've seen sort of the full spectrum in my career. I think the full spectrum. I'm always looking to expand that and to use everything I can in my life and career to help create more and more cultures that are a speak up culture where it is safe and worth it to speak up because it's better for business and it's better for health.
Yeah, that's one comment there is so it, that NIH study really defines that there is such a thing as a work husband.
That's funny. but
in that vein, like when you started to come into your voice, was there a person in particular who you felt like was that person that gave you the opportunity?
I would say two people. One was my grandfather, who also had a stutter. He was a Holocaust survivor, and his story of survivorship was very unique. He was an entrepreneur. He came from a family of butchers. He actually left formal education because he punched back an anti-Semitic teacher who was harassing him. That was when he was 14 years old and was the last day of formal education he ever received. And he joined the family business. And he ended up fighting in 39 against the invading Germans as a Polish infantry. Was in a prisoner of war camp for 2 years, escaped, walked home for about 6 weeks at night, and then married his childhood sweetheart, my grandmother, Eva. And then he led a group of seven, which became five, in hiding in the Polish countryside, mostly through farmers he knew at the beginning or middle of that war. And it became increasingly harder as the war went on and then ended. But he had this sort of, he survived the Holocaust as an entrepreneur, sort of on his own terms. And so he was very willing, gregariously, even with the stutter, and in a second language, Polish and Yiddish were his first languages, and English was a third or fourth. But he would enthrall people with telling his life story, even though he had a stutter. And that was definitely a huge inspiration of mine. And the other was I had a professor at college, Dr. Dennis Shackle, who's a Kiwi from New Zealand. And he had a class on advanced presentation skills. And I remember him showing a clip of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., his I Have a Dream speech at the end of the first class. And he said, your opportunity or your invitation for our next class is to come back and share a 5-minute speech with as much passion as Dr. King displayed, which is no small order.
No.
But I remember sitting in that class saying, I have to talk about overcoming my fear of public speaking. And that was the first time I openly spoke about having a stutter and overcoming a stutter. And it's so interesting because speaking up and publicly speaking is a universal fear. I mean, there's the Jerry Seinfeld joke, which is on facts, that the number one fear in North America is public speaking and the number two fear is death. So you'd rather be in the casket than giving the eulogy, which makes no sense whatsoever. It's a Seinfeld joke and it's true. But this experience of having a fear of public speaking, you don't need to have a stutter to have a fear of public speaking. And so I was able to share my experience, and I think I helped normalize and humanize a fear that everyone in that room had. So those are sort of two main people that really influenced me.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And so communicating needs. I want to turn to this for a minute. Mm-hmm. Many of us in personal or work relationships have trouble communicating needs around a chronic condition, or even sometimes it can bleed into other parts of our lives. What advice would you have for people as they try to navigate, as they try to, you talk a little bit in the book about taking agency. If agency is handed to you, take it.
Yeah.
And I lovingly say, if you don't take it, maybe that, you know, that's work that maybe needs to be done individually. But
or at least personal work. Work in community or with others, but work you got to take on. Yeah.
Yeah. So any tips or tricks to navigate conversations effectively?
I mean, one is, I think there's a couple things, and as I say this, I'm aware that this could stoke fear. This isn't easy. So I share this with as much empathy as I can. So one is, I think the sort of blanket and overall feedback is to attempt to feed the relationships that feed you. And so personal relationships, family relationships, friends, colleagues, who are the people that believe you? Who are the people that have your back? Who are the people that are curious and open-minded and accommodating and compassionate and empathetic? One of the challenges is sometimes our experience might be that the very folks that we expect to or that we want to most, which could be a life partner or a sibling or a parent, are the ones who don't believe or the ones who actually make it harder. That's really hard. I just had a conversation with a colleague earlier this week who's really trying to play big in their life and career. And they come from a family that lives in a small town who hasn't come out of the house since COVID. And they don't play big. And she has a hard time navigating that. But she's just said, I've made up my mind. I want to live my life the way I want to live my life. I'm not showing up attempting to harm others. I'm really trying to show up to live a life of service, to have as much impact as possible. And though my family doesn't understand why I traveled to Abu Dhabi as a female trying to do work to advance my passion, I'm going to do it anyway, even though they don't get it. So one is, how can we feed the relationships that feed us? And I'm a really big believer, and I say this knowing that it isn't a fair comment, but how can we show our true colors as we meet people and quickly? Something that my wife did on like our second date is she was very intentional in sharing a same-sex relationship in her family blatantly to see how I would respond. It was a test. Because if I wasn't okay with it, that's a problem. But the fact that I was like, yeah, love is love. We're good. Like, I was curious. That's fantastic. Beautiful. That was a check for her.
Right.
And so it's kind of like, you know, one of my biggest fears was lying in an interview, because what if you got the job? You'd have to keep up that lie. And so can you find a workplace where you can be open and clear in the interview process such that they know what they're getting? And the beautiful thing about human beings is we all have strengths. Every single one of us has strengths. And you know, Jill, that I use the analogy of pickle brine when it comes to culture, that, you know, we're all cucumbers. We can be the best cucumber there is, but if we're in a bad brine, we become an awful pickle, and we can't blame the cucumber. We have to examine the brine. So I'm mindful that there's pressure to get hired, but how can we actually find places of work where we're rewarded for being authentic and respectful? So
yeah,
that's advice that may not be easy to take, but advice that I would focus on is feed the relationships that feed you.
No, and I was at a conference a couple years ago, and somebody said, was one of those moments where you go, oh man, that really sunk in. And they said, if you don't get up every morning and go to work every day and feel like you're heard and you're supported and the work you're doing is important, and you can be yourself, you're living in a cage. And I was like, oh, that's a hard one to swallow. But I think a lot of us, and a lot of us do that. And I think it takes us to our next step, which is really vulnerability.
Just one comment there, if I could.
Yeah.
So the other thing, so a couple of things to point out on that cage, which I agree with. I would also add that I'm often asked, Jill, you know, what's an organization that has a great speak up culture? And I say, no comment, because organizations change based on who's leading them, and teams change based on who's leading them. You could work at an organization that has an awful reputation, but work for a great leader. You could also work at an organization that has a fantastic reputation, but work for a leader who isn't good for you, or who's an insecure leader, or who puts you in a cage. And so, you know, that's why I'm not a believer of a dream job. There's a dream career path. And I think we have to be mindful of who are we working with, who's leading us. And also, you know, the tail can wag the dog. That, you know, so often folks are, if only my leader, what are they doing? And it's like, okay, it's worthwhile to talk about our struggles, but also what are we doing? And how are we showing up and leading in the way that we wish to be led, or lead in a way that we think is worth following?
And that can filter through all of our relationships, just work, right?
Yes. Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah. And within an organization can influence up, down, and side to side. And it bleeds into our other relationships outside of work as well. Absolutely.
And I'll say that it can be difficult, right? I mean, and you've been through this with stuttering. It can be difficult because you've piled so much on yourself, and you have to start layering that off and like taking the layers. It's like being in Chicago in the winter when we actually have winter. But this idea of vulnerability, because vulnerability I always say, like, we can all do things we want to do, and we can like rip the band-aids off, but we have to be prepared for what comes after that.
Yeah.
And some of that vulnerability, I think, is your access. What do you recommend when someone doesn't want to be perceived as weak or vulnerable? Mm. In an organization, I know, like, and that perception thing for me, I'm a huge fan of Jay Shetty. And the first time I ever heard him talk, he said, to stop living as a perception of a perception of yourself. And I think that concept, it makes us afraid of being vulnerable.
Yeah. So, I mean, I have a bunch of thoughts here. So one is, I think so often our experience as human beings, I sort of learned or made this observation early in my life and career, sort of in my early 20s. And it's really guided a way that I've developed confidence, which is everyone is always worried about others think of them. Instead of worrying about what others think of you, just worry to show up and serve. So a perfect example, you walk in late to a meeting or you roll into a room late to a meeting, you're self-conscious, oh my God, I'm late, right? And you're aware of what people are, like people look at you, right? But if you notice the behavior and the body language of others as you walk in late to a room, all of a sudden they sit up straighter because they're now thinking, what do they think of me? So right. Everyone is just constantly worried about what do other people think of me. Just as much as you can, try to shut that off and just worry about serving and being helpful. I think it's a great way to be more successful in life and in career. I'll pause and see if there's comment there before I speak more about
vulnerability. Well, I love that. And it's, was it Eleanor Roosevelt that said, don't be something to the effect of, don't be so worried about, if you're worried about what others think, you'd be surprised at how little they do.
Yeah, that's funny.
I thought that was a good one. I heard years ago, but that show up and serve, I really like that, because when we serve, we get outside of ourselves. Is that a good way to say it?
Oh, totally. Yeah. And I mean, neurochemically, it's good because when we serve, we get oxytocin, which is great for our long-term health and growth. I mean, serving is what makes us unique as a species. It's what's kept us around for so long, is our ability to cooperate and help one another. So, you know, we try to teach our young kids who are 8 and 5 now that, you know, we have simple guidelines and rules in our home. And one of them is be a helper person, be the type of person who shows up to help others. And you can always find other helper people. That's just a belief in our ethos as a family here that we strive to permeate and do. It's a better version of the world that we want to live in.
That's beautiful.
Vulnerability. We didn't talk about vulnerability.
Let's do it because this is, I think this is really important.
Yeah. So a couple things, you know, vulnerability can be positively contagious. Vulnerability begets more vulnerability. The irony about vulnerability is though it feels as though you're being weak, it's actually experienced as a view of strength and of courage. There is a prerequisite to vulnerability, and it is creating psychological safety or a speak-up culture. It's very hard to ask people to be vulnerable if the feeling or the experience is that vulnerability is taken advantage of. So if folks are vulnerable and then that information is used against them, it's a perfect way to breed a toxic culture and to ensure that you have a culture where people aren't vulnerable and they spend far more time lying, faking, and hiding with politics high and egos high, and that's not good. But if we create an environment where vulnerability is held sacred, vulnerability is rewarded, vulnerability is viewed as a strength, vulnerability is viewed as a key teaming tool, and all high-performing teams have vulnerability because a high-performing team needs to wear their strengths, weaknesses, and limitations on their sleeve, because we need to know what are the strengths, limitations, and weaknesses of the folks around us so that we know who should step up and who should step back or step aside given a particular context. So vulnerability does not mean sharing all things with all people all the time. That's called oversharing, and it might not be suitable. Vulnerability is about context. So given the context, what's appropriate for me to share for me and us to be most successful as a team? Vulnerability is a high-performing team tool.
I love that reference to everyone knowing their strengths and weaknesses and limitations, right? I drew on my paper a SWOT analysis,
nice.
A SWOT box, but right. That's where you can take the opportunity. If you know strengths and weaknesses within a team or a family or a group of friends or whatever it is, if I know what your strength is, I can offset something threatening by using your strength, or I can take advantage of an opportunity to complement a weakness of a colleague or a family member and sort of cross over into the flip of it, which is the toes.
Yes. Yes. And it shouldn't be used as an excuse not to do the work, but like, I'll give you a couple of examples. So, I have a high performing team at home. It's called my wife and I, it's high trusted. It's high performance most of the time. At least high performance most of the time, high trust all the time, I would say, but we work at it. And we each have unique strengths. So like one of my wife's strengths is she's far more detail oriented than I am. She has more patience than I do. Like I'm quintessential. Like I'm about to make a toy for our kids. I don't like to read the instructions. I don't have the patience for it. She does. When it comes to admin stuff or particular detailed things on taxes, like I will lean into her for her support. It doesn't mean I can totally just say that's your problem. No, I still have to own my room in the house, but I will lean into her when it comes to details and admin, that things that I just are harder for me that drain energy. Now, there's something that I'm particularly good at, which is helping people find words to express their ideas and their emotions, when my wife has to write an email, when she has to write a birthday card or a thank you note, has to have a hard conversation, I'm her go-to. We will rehearse that. We will talk about it. And I'm a real value for her there. It's a team. We each have strengths and weaknesses and limitations. And the opportunity is to amplify our strengths and mitigate weaknesses and limitations. Still take responsibility and accountability, but delegate if we can.
Yeah. Okay. So let's turn, can we turn to a spot, which is the doctor's office or the care setting.
Yeah.
And I would say, as we go through this, that speak up culture for your provider and when you're sitting there in the room is all, probably just as important as other areas of your life. It tends to be, we hear a lot from a lot of patients, it's lacking. People feel like they go to a doctor, they tell their story, and then they get a canned response. Women in particular, underrepresented groups in particular, we know, you know, are not always heard. Any tips on how to maybe like train your providers to come along in the journey?
Yeah, I mean, and the other thing I wanted to say in our previous conversation around skills and teaming is, just because somebody else is good at something, if it drains their energy too, there's a difference between a skill and a strength. A skill is something you're good at. A strength is something you're good at that you enjoy and it gives you energy. So it's not okay to be like, well, you're good at taking notes, do it all the time. That's not okay. So right. That's just another sort of caveat I wanted to add in.
Nobody gives me that job ever.
Nice. That's that means you have a strong personal brand there, Jill.
I do. It's called not spell checking or writing in full sentences.
Sure. You take good bullet point SWOT analysis. Yeah. So the particular question on doctor's office. Yeah.
Yeah.
So what I would say is, to the greatest degree, can you articulate your needs? Are you able to get your needs so clear? Can you even take notes on your needs or have someone support you with that? Are you able to go into a medical environment or setting with an advocate with you, with another human being, if it's possible, to help advocate, to help ensure that what you need is getting across? You know, it's challenging because if you're not getting what you want, the option to get other care can be a challenge. But I just heard a story from a friend who had their OBGYN essentially say, you should abort. And she went, no, I'd like to be referred to a specialist, please. You're not a specialist in this. Like, you can't tell me to do that. You're giving me a month, 4 weeks to make a decision. Let me use those 4 weeks and get more educated, because I don't, like, you're not a specialist in this. So can you know your needs, and can you advocate for what you need? And hopefully as a team, not as an individual, because it's so hard to navigate that as a solo person. So can you get help, and can you get clear in articulating what it is that you need? The other thing I'll just highlight is, there is a study that was done where doctors' communication was replaced with an AI equivalent, and the AI was something like 46% more empathetic than the doctor's communication.
Whoa.
And we know that time pressure, financial pressure, there's external pressures on doctors that are making it harder and harder for them to be empathetic. It doesn't give them a hall pass or an excuse. But I mean, for a doctor, can you employ AI to have at least your emails be more empathetic while still delivering the same information from a medical perspective?
Right.
So it's just a really interesting that I think time pressures are creating less empathy in an experience. And how can we either use tools to support that or attempt to attack that systemic issue of there being so much pressure?
That's fascinating. An AI doesn't tend to be very empathetic.
Yeah, but If you coach it, and I think you do coach it, there's also in the same study, if you're polite to AI, it'll perform better, which is really interesting. So the kinder you are to AI, the better it performs.
I've learned to say please and thank you to ChatGPT for sure. So on that note, any other thoughts of navigating the world with a chronic illness? And I think the needs thing, I'm just going to back up there for a second, because understanding what we need is not an easy task sometimes, especially when you, right, when you're navigating just regular life and then you dump a chronic illness on it. But I think from my experience on the leadership side of my leaders, asking me what I need really opens the door. And that is, it's so refreshing, right? Because someone's connecting to you on and trying to find the common ground of how you become successful, whether it's a spouse or a friend or a boss or a coworker. What other areas do you think are important in the journey of getting to speak up culture on either side, whether you're I like to think everyone's equal. So tell me what you think are the most let's land on the key points of how we get to the speak up culture to evolve.
Yeah. So I think a few things. So one, there's an organization I've done some work with that they've got rid of the term individual contributor, which I love. They now call them individual leaders, leaders of teams, and leaders of leaders. And so regardless of where you are, each and every one of us can behave as a leader does. Even if you don't have any reports and you aren't formally a capital L leader, as I like to call it, you can still lead through your behavior. You can lead your work, you can lead in your relationships, you can lead yourself. And so as leaders, as those who have influence, and we all do have some influence, some of us more than others, our whisper is a shout and our tiptoes are stomps, especially as you get more influence inside of an organization or a culture, your whisper is a shout and your tiptoes are stomps, that your individual values and behaviors have impact on other folks. And so, you know, more so for leaders, I guess, is believe your people, like believe them. Now, just because someone is struggling doesn't mean that they're fragile and weak. They can still take feedback. And so I still think, you know, I love my favorite equation for feedback is the FBI formula. One, because it's fun to say and it's useful to have language. But, you know, oftentimes we're either too afraid to provide feedback, we just avoid it, or we build it up until it boils over. And then we dump on someone in a performance evaluation. And it's like, you've been feeling this for 3 months or 6 months or a year, and you're just telling me now. The standard that I have in my work and my practice with clients is there should be no surprises in performance reviews. That's why they're called a review, not a performance surprise. And so the standard is, if you have feedback, you should deliver it such that by the time you get to a formal conversation, it's a review. And I think a great way to work on that is FBI. So oftentimes when we do provide feedback, it's either shallow or it's hurtful. And I think it could be better. So FBI stands for feeling behavior impact. So instead of saying, hey, Jill, great job today, you know, that's meaningless. Like, what can you do with great job? I could say, hey, Jill, I really want to thank you and team for all that you've done to behavior, communicate, prepare, impact. I'm so bought into this conversation. And the feeling is I'm just grateful and excited. Thanks. That's way better than just great work. There's nothing we can replicate with great work. Now, let's say I'm making up a scenario, but let's say I'm late to 3 meetings in a week and it's really frustrating for you. Instead of saying, hey, Shed, you're lazy, that wouldn't go so well. I would get pretty defensive. You could say, Shed, I feel really let down when you were late to three meetings last week. And the impact is, I'm not sure we can trust you with what's on your plate right now. Now the bonus with a constructive FBI is an open-ended question. What's going on? This isn't like you. Now it's a dialogue, right? Feedback is a dish best shared, not served, right? Especially when you're more senior. I've worked for a senior leader that anytime there was feedback, it was negative, and it was always telling me what I had done wrong recently. And there was no room for like, can I share you about my experience? No. It was a message to be delivered, not a message to start dialogue. The purpose of feedback is to help one another and our relationship grow. And so for you, if you're struggling with a chronic illness, how can you use the FBI? As well as if you're someone who works with someone who's suffering with a chronic illness, can you still lean into the FBI and say, I honor your experience, I'm here to support you, and I need to be honest with some things that are either going great and I want to see more of, I want to catch you doing good things and right things and have you do more of them, or some honest, real conversations around struggles and how can we redesign our relationship or our alliance here to make it better for you and make it better for me.
I love that. Okay, we're going to land on that note because that was, tell me again what FBI stands for.
FBI stands for the Federal Bureau. Oh, sorry. Feeling, Behavior, Impact.
Feeling, Behavior, Impact.
Yeah.
Wow, if we all communicated that way, and I'm probably one of the worst, it would be a much different world for all of us.
I'm up for it. Yes, please.
Okay. Last question, and then we're going to let you off the hot seat. Hope for the future based on all you know.
Oh, my God. Oh, you're going to make me cry.
Sorry.
Nah, that's all good. It's just data. Emotions are data. You know, my work is deeply personal. It's deeply personal from a perspective of overcoming some really challenging things in my life and striving to help others do the same. It's also personal around peace. I mean, I've written, fully admit that I've written a philosophy book disguised as a business book. I don't care about business. I care about people. And if to your point, if we communicated this way, where we owned our own feelings and emotions and invited somebody else to share theirs, what better version of a world, what better version of humanity we would live in? You know, we live in a world where there's wars and lack of human rights and freedom. We live in a world where those with power take advantage of those who do not. My hope for the world is that we live in a far more humane world. Or at least go over to Mars and try to do it better there. Because, you know, with what I see going on in the world today, with both the polarities of love and hate, fear and safety, I am both in any given day so horrified of how destructive humanity can be and absolutely inspired with hope by how beautiful and generative humanity can be. We all have a good wolf and a bad wolf. I just want us to feed the good wolf. And so my hope is this conversation and our work, the work that I know we are both up to, Jill, helps to create more good, because I just have a deep-seated belief that human beings can be good and human beings can make progress. That's what's gotten us here.
Wow. Well, my friend Shed, we're going to land it there. And I'm going to say, I'm so grateful for the people who helped you find your voice, because you have a beautiful way of framing things and framing the world. And I think all of our listeners would agree that we feel very lucky to have had you here today on Spondycast.
Thank you so much. It's been a delight. To join you today and to know you. You've become a close friend, so I really appreciate it.
Yeah. All right, that's a wrap. SpondyCast was made possible by donations from the Spondylitis Association of America's individual members and our show's corporate sponsor, AbbVie.
Since our founding in 1983, the Spondylitis Association of America has been the face, voice, and leading nationwide nonprofit, educating, empowering, and advocating for people living with spondyloarthritis. Through our extensive work with patients, the medical community, and partners, we provide information and resources to help people impacted by the disease live better lives and champion research to find a cure.